This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
That anymore. You see, your governments have a budget crisis. You can't afford this anymore, which is patently absurd. Our economies are four times more productive than they were in the 1970s. We can afford four times more than we used to be able to afford.
And KBOO News reporter Robin Ryan interviews one city worker whose job is on the chopping block in the budget city council will vote on this Wednesday.
Our maintenance crew is down to bare bones. We're so far behind all of us, not just the carpenters, to eliminate all the capability of carpentry work is, I don't get it. I don't see how they're going to function.
I'm Robin Hanel, currently visiting professor in the economics department at PSU, where I've been for the last 3 years. Was visiting professor at Lewis and Clark before that, and I'm professor emeritus, retired from American University back in Washington, D.C. Live here in Portland, lived in southeast Portland the first 5 years, and have just moved to northeast Portland.
So give us a wonky economics definition of austerity, and then give us a sort of an operational definition, what that looks like and smells like.
Okay. Fiscal austerity is what an economist would call it. And fiscal austerity is cutting back on government spending. Now, it can take two forms. One is you can actually lay off public employees. Well, when you lay off public employees, you've immediately created more unemployment. And when those public employees you've laid off, they then have less income. And they buy less from local businesses. They don't take vacations. So you get this ripple effect, it's called a multiplier effect, where when you lay off public employees, they're unemployed, they have less income, they spend less, the businesses therefore that, you know, don't get that income, they have to lay off private employees, and you get a kind of multiplier effect where every employee you lay off is going to lead to two or three more employees over the next 3 years that's going to be laid off in the private sector. Well, what if you don't lay off employees, you just cut the budget of a program, but you don't cut you don't cut personnel, you just cut spending. Well, who's the city program buying from? They're buying from local businesses, and therefore you don't avoid the job loss because you didn't lay off a public employee. When the city spends less, then whatever business was selling to the city that the city isn't buying anymore, they have to lay people off. So either way, the austerity amounts to increasing job losses. The truth of the matter is the budget deficit isn't going to go away until the economy recovers. And if what you do in response to the budget deficit is to just cut your spending, you're going to make the recession even worse, and you're going to make the budget crisis next year even worse than it was. Now, why have people forgotten this lesson? In large part, it's because the 1% have now decided to use this crisis of their creation to cut all the spending programs that they never wanted to have going on in the first place. And it's become a mammoth excuse worldwide to basically cut back on all of the programs that benefited the majority of people that were implemented in the European economies during the 20th century, in the US and Canada during the 20th century. The 1% is now preaching to the rest of us, you can't afford that anymore. You see, your governments have a budget crisis. You can't afford this anymore, which is patently absurd. Our economies are four times more productive than they were in the 1970s. We can afford four times more than we used to be able to afford.
Last Thursday, the city of Portland held their final community budget forum to talk about the budget for fiscal year 2013-14. There were six community forums to bring community stakeholders, parents, workers, small business owners together to talk about what to cut, essentially. Six forums pitting services and programs against each other. Not a single forum to discuss how we pay for what we want.
Right. The city government has focused on, first of all, they've accepted the necessity. They haven't fought nearly hard enough against the bad situation that the state and the federal government programs have put them in. They essentially have accepted the role of being the handmaiden of austerity. So city officials that are being responsible leaders need to be playing a major role in telling Salem, you can't do this to us anymore. Telling Washington, D.C., you can't do this to us anymore. The other thing that they have done is, even in the narrow sense of where are we going to come up with the $21 million, they looked only on the spending side, what to cut. They did not look at all. They didn't have a single forum, I have seen nothing to indicate that they made any serious attempt to look for what I would call fat on the revenue side of the budget, where there must be, you know, there are failures to collect certain taxes and certain fees that we can no longer tolerate. With the precedent of a 3-year temporary income tax in a situation that was not as big a crisis as the one we have here, why weren't the city officials, why wasn't that the first thing on their, you know, at the top of their list?
That is a really interesting point. I've been asking myself the same question. It seems like post-2008, the 1% and our elected officials have actually fused more tightly.
Right.
2008 was scary for everyone.
Yes.
2008 was so bad for everyone.
It was a shock, and it made almost everybody ask, how could this have happened? We were told by every authority in the land that such a thing can't happen, and yet it did. And a bunch of us who were economists who were warning of this kind of thing have been sort of trying to explain ever since, well, when you deregulate finance, when you allow income differentials to just go completely out of sight, you create dangerous situations, and at some point there's going to be, at some point a crisis is going to come when you allow these kinds of policies to proceed. But the dominant reaction of the people responsible for creating it has been to use the crisis to essentially try and squeeze out of the 99%. And that's what's going on. I mean, that's what austerity is about. The other thing, the other reason the city officials should have looked just as hard, they should have looked harder at the revenue side of the budget than they did on the spending side of the budget. Because sort of elemental economics tells you that when you cut spending by a dollar, you create more joblessness than when you raise taxes by a dollar. So it was very disturbing to hear city officials and the mayor in particular, when he was asked about, well, you have a budget crisis, so, I mean, what are you thinking about raising taxes? And his answer was, well, I don't think when we have a very high unemployment rate that this would be the time to be thinking about raising taxes. Well, it's certainly not the time to be thinking about cutting spending, because when the government cuts spending, it causes more joblessness than when the government raises taxes. And if you look at what we're cutting our spending on, you should realize, well, we don't want to cut our spending on those things. And therefore, you should immediately go over and say, we need to look at alternative new sources of revenues, because we have spending needs that are legitimate, and because those are the things we need in the long run. And that would be an income tax. And the income tax they did in 2003, it was a very bad income tax. It was not progressive. It was 1.5% for everybody. Down to, I think, if your tax filing is a single person, if you had $2,500 in income, you were paying the same 1.5% tax for 3 years as somebody who was earning $1 million a year. So we had, that's not even as progressive as the Oregon state income tax. So A, the city should do an income tax that's not temporary. B, they should do an income tax that is progressive, that has somewhat higher rates for people in higher income brackets than lower income brackets. They could do that, and they could do that completely easily by just piggybacking on the state income tax. But nobody in this city government didn't seem to cross anybody's mind. For some reason, this was an unthinkable response to the crisis that is requiring the necessity of cutting these programs that, you know, that people's lives depend on.
And what should the city of Portland be doing instead of implementing a cuts-only job-killing budget?
They need to look on the revenue side of the budget harder than they are on the cutting side of the budget. They should immediately be considering doing a county income tax. And that would be a stable, reliable source of revenue so that we are not in these emergency situations that are driving people crazy. In the very short run, everybody knows that because of the way tax assessment is done, there are some neighborhoods that are paying less than they should. It's troublesome to increase the frequency of your assessments, but in a time when you are, you know, shutting down programs that are vitally necessary for people, well, then they should be making special efforts to be sure that every section of the city is actually paying their fair share of the property taxes. They should go ahead and pass a cell phone tax. The landline tax was controversial. It was recent. It had a disparate impact on old people. And a cell phone tax would raise considerable revenues. It's already been done in Eugene. So it's easy, and the question is, hasn't anybody been looking at that? A big part of the problem is that 15% of the property, of the property tax base in the city is off limits to the general fund, and the immediate crisis is a shortfall in the general fund. You have to look and see how did that happen, and that happened because of bad policies that have to be stopped immediately. There's a 2.2%, basically a business profit tax on City of Portland. It's not progressive. The state of Oregon has a business profit tax, and it is progressive. So you basically need to increase that business profit tax. You don't have to increase the 2.2% on the small businesses at the bottom, but it should be higher for larger businesses, and there's no reason the city can't do that. If it did that, it could also rectify another sort of major historical problem in terms of the tax code for the city. Businesses that only have $50,000, if you have $50,000 worth of revenues of sales in the city, you are subject to the 2.2% tax. That means that your average food cart is paying the same business tax that the Bank of America is, you know, for their business they do in the city of Portland. That's just ridiculous. You need a progressive business tax. It will raise more money. And if you do that, you can actually raise that $50,000 to $150,000 and not tax food carts and very, very small businesses at all. Why do you do that? Because it's more fair. It's also basically going to be helpful employment, because small businesses hire more people per dollar than large businesses.
I love to play music with a message on this show. Today I'll feature Chicago native hip-hop duo Rebel Diaz and their solidarity anthem, Chicago Teacher.
Truly inspired. Here we go. Come on. Look. Yo. Yo. I was taught by a Chicago teacher, Chicago teacher, Chicago teacher. I learned to read and write from a Chicago teacher, so I'm inspired by the fight from my Chicago teachers. Homie, I was taught by a Chicago teacher, Chicago teacher, Chicago teacher. I learned to read and write from a Chicago teacher, so I'm inspired by the fight from my Chicago teachers. The teachers are tired, the students dumbfounded, the budgets get cut so classes are overcrowded. Streets full of violence, the blue coat is silence, so I'ma keep rhyming till salaries start rising. The unions are rising, taking to the streets. The workers are united, so the mayor's got beef. Rhymes a fake pretender with a corporate agenda, neoliberal offender. Of course you offend us. This ain't about money, that's far from the truth. They want better work conditions to teach the youth. Politicians, I don't trust them, it's all in the name. The president, the mayor, all want political gain. They'd rather put the kids in jail, shackle them with chains, than provide an education that challenges the brain. Top-down education, Chicago the birthplace, now it's spreading nationwide all over the place. They don't teach us how to think, they teach us how to test, they teach us how to work to put money in their checks. The CEOs need to get up out the classroom before these streets get hotter than the sand in Cancun. So join the picket line like Mr. Pickett in his prime. Put on your red
red shirt like the Bulls in 95. Hit the streets with a sign to say I'm fighting for mine. It's a fork in the road and you gotta choose a side. And yes, I'm proud to say I was a public school student. It was public school teachers that first taught me music. And yes, I'm proud to say I was a public school student. A public school teacher first taught me music. Homie, I was taught by a Chicago teacher. Chicago teacher, Chicago teacher. I learned to read and write from a Chicago teacher. So I'm inspired by the fight for my Chicago teachers. Yeah, ha. Bateman Elementary, where Illinois went. Lincoln School, Blaine Tech, Lincoln Park High School. DJ Illinois went to Roosevelt, and now he producing beats worldwide. Let's go.
That was Rebel Diaz, Chicago Teacher, a song that breaks down the corporate agenda behind the racist school closures and so-called reforms that parents, students, and teachers are fighting right now in the hallways and in the streets of Chicago.
Let's talk about immediate things that the city could do to avoid painful, draconian cuts.
If you cut spending, you will make the recession worse. You will add to unemployment. What you want to do is avoid that to the extent that's possible. One way to avoid that, the most immediate way that would avoid that, would be to go and look into the special funds that are sitting there in part for the purpose of an emergency. The city government cannot say on the one hand, this is a terrible emergency. That's why we have to do these terrible cuts. And at the same time say, we have funds that are partly for the purpose of being used in an emergency, but we won't even open them up. We won't even talk about taking some of the money in order not to cut these programs out of those funds. Now, part of the purpose of those funds is to accumulate money to replace equipment down the line. And so you don't want to take all of the money out of those funds. But they've been, frankly, very squirrely about what are you doing with these funds, exactly what is it they're going to be used for, because I don't think they really, it gives the appearance they don't want people to be able to scrutinize how important it is to keep money in these particular funds for the future, given the fact that that means that you've got to lay off 180 people right now this year.
I'm talking with Fire Bureau worker Scott Cooper. Can you tell me, Mr. Cooper, how long have you been working for the city and in what capacity?
I've been with the Fire Bureau as a maintenance carpenter since 1999, 14 years.
And how do you spend your days?
Working. One of my expertises was in cabinetry. That was one of the reasons why they hired me. Their cabinet maker had left, and they needed a cabinet maker because the stations require a lot of specialty cabinets and things for the firefighters.
How many buildings do you oversee the needs of?
We have 31 fire stations and 4 other administration buildings, so 35 and multiple outbuildings and storage sheds.
And it's you and one other coworker?
Yes, our maintenance crew is 6 workers, 1 painter, 3 facilities maintenance techs. They handle the light, electrical, the HVAC, the plumbing, things of that nature, and then 2 carpenters. I'm one of the 2 carpenters.
And what do you understand is the status of your relationship with the city now?
The 2 carpenter positions are being eliminated. It's kind of mind-boggling why... Or how they can run a maintenance program without carpenters. I posed a question yesterday to them, why not keep at least one? And they said because of budgets, they were going to proceed with eliminating both positions.
And how do you think the Fire Bureau is going to meet the needs of those buildings in the aftermath?
Well, they told me they were going to hire it out to outside contractors. They have been hiring it out because we have so much work. And that was their reasoning was we have so much work, we're so far behind that they can't get caught up, so they're hiring out the work as of right now, but then they're also eliminating our positions. So it just doesn't make sense to us.
How much do they think they're going to save by cutting you loose, and how much will they spend in the new manner of doing business?
We posed that question to them, and they didn't have an answer because they haven't looked into it. I know that there's about 140 work orders right now that I have and my partner. There's a conservative amount would be at least 6 to 8 months worth of work, and the work comes in daily. The work has to be done, so they're going to pay somebody to do it. We've found that a lot of my repair work, not new construction, but the repair is to fix shoddy workmanship done on the outside. So in essence, we're doing the work twice. So if they're going to have the rest of the work done by outside contractors, not to say that outside contractors are all bad. Firefighters are real rough and they're tough and they're hard on stuff. And I have to build the items that I build stronger and heavier than you would get for a regular home, because they're just hard on things, and so they don't last. So I usually end up replacing outside built work. It's like schoolwork. The cabinetry in schools, the kids are going to swing on the door, so we build the doors to hold up. We don't want them to get hurt. It's like with parks. We don't want to build community centers that are going to fall apart and break, because it's the community that needs to be protected. Fire stations, they're rough, they're tough. You've got 8 people in the double station. They're there for 24 hours. They use that station, and they don't have time to do the work themselves. They need to be freed up to be able to do a better service to the public when they need to be there. Our maintenance crew is down to bare bones. We're so far behind, all of us, not just the carpenters, to eliminate all the capability of carpentry work is, I don't get it. I don't see how they're going to function.
Doesn't sound like sensibility applied to procurement now, does it?
Short term, it could look like it's saving money for that day or that year, but long term, it costs twice as much. In fact, last week we just had to repair, there was two toilets that were falling off the wall because they weren't installed properly. We had to cut into the wall and embrace them and repair them. And this was a station that is only 2 years old. Trying to save money during the builds, you end up with problems. So all these stations are starting to have problems of this nature. So the work is going to keep coming. It's going to keep compounding. And it's just not going to save any money not to fix them.
And you've been through a similar experience like this before with Portland Public Schools, is that correct?
That's correct. I worked 13 years with them at the same capacity doing cabinetry for the classrooms and millwork for the schools and general maintenance. If they would have kept even a half of the workforce for 10 years, it would have been only one quarter to one third of the cost of these $400 million bond that they want to bring these up to standard. In fact, some of the schools have gotten so bad they just have to replace them. But when I had left there, our schools were the best maintained in the nation. They were, I was really proudful of the work that we did. And it's just disheartening to see them go downhill. And my children have all gone to Portland Public Schools, so to watch the disintegration of those has been really hard for me to see. And I really, really don't want to see that happen to the firehouses.
So it's a personal experience that you're able to speak from in terms of knowing that in the long run, the costs are greater than the saving mechanisms they think they're deciding on today.
Yes, I live in the city of Portland. I pay taxes, although my wage comes from the taxes. So I can see the long-term effect. It looks good on paper for a year, but long-term, it costs the taxpayer 2 to 3 times as much money to fix the stuff when it's gone to disrepair.
It's been wonderful talking to you. Thanks for taking the time.
Thank you very much.
That's it for tonight's edition of Labor Radio. As always, this show and more materials can be found at kboo.fm/laborradio. Now stay tuned for Prison Pipeline at 6:30. This was Megan Heiss for Labor Radio, your KBOO show of, by, and for the working class.
Make it work. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Oregon Southwest Washington Carpenters Local 156, whose goal is to organize workers, provide a safe work environment, ensure livable wages, and elevate the moral and social condition of its members. Information at ubc156.org. Stay tuned now for Prison Pipeline.
From farms in Oregon's fertile Willamette Valley to the food desert of inner city Richmond, California, a new documentary film, Gaining Ground, reveals the ingenuity and courage of urban and rural farmers committed to serving and empowering their communities.
Boy, unless people figure out that we need to feed our neighbors locally and sustainably, I don't know what they're going to be farming in a few years.
We live in a classic food desert. People go to their liquor stores, their corner stores, whatever. Food is an issue.
On Saturday, June 1st at 7 p.m., the Media Project presents a short preview of Gaining Ground, a film by Elaine Velasquez and KBOO host Barbara Bernstein. This benefit to raise finishing funds for the film takes place at the Fifth Avenue Cinema, 510 Southwest Hall Street in downtown Portland. This event is sponsored by KBOO Community Radio, Food and Water Watch, Portland Bureau of Planning and Sustainability, and the West Multnomah Soil and Water Conservation District. More information can be found online at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the events page.
Freedom of movement for free people. The issue of immigration is boiling hot in America. Every potential presidential candidate has an opinion and, if necessary, will find another one if he thinks he can get a few more Latino votes.
Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be an angel? When everything goes wrong, you see some bad. But I'm just a soul who's intent.
Good evening. This is Prison Pipeline on KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland. Prison Pipeline presents a unique perspective of the criminal justice system, addressing the root causes of crime and broadening understanding of the institution of incarceration. Welcome. I'm your host this evening, Carlos Chavez. Tonight's program will discuss a different kind of incarceration, one that deals with a more underground group of people that we all in this country rely on every day. I'm talking about our immigrant communities and immigrant detention. In just a moment, we'll hear an interview that I did recently with Stephen Manning, a partner at Immigrant Law Group, PC. He's a member of the Amicus Committee for the American Immigration Lawyers Association, on which he coordinates nationwide litigation strategies to advance the rights of immigrants and asylees. He's received many national and local awards for his work on behalf of immigrants and refugees, including the Jack Wasserman Award for Excellence in Immigration Litigation and the Edith Lowenstein Award for Excellence in Advancing the Practice of Immigration Law. Stephen Manning represents immigrants and their families in all immigration matters. He's been tireless in his federal litigation efforts before the district courts and appeals courts. He also volunteers extensively in the community and enjoys tackling difficult cases. We'll turn our attention now to that interview. All right, so the first topic that I'd like to jump into is just basically I want to differentiate between people being incarcerated for criminal activity, and I want to differentiate that from folks that get detained for, you know, immigrant status. I wonder if you could kind of paint that picture for folks. The media tends to kind of scare folks into thinking that immigrants are criminals.
So the immigrant detention system is the largest civil detention system in the world, the United States system. It detains more people civilly than any other system anywhere. The principle, there's a couple reasons why we detain, why the U.S. government decides to detain individuals for immigration purposes. It's not for punishment. Right? So anyone who's detained who's an immigrant who's in detention is not, in theory, like the legal theory, is not to punish them. It's rather to make sure that they're going to comply with the immigration court's orders, or that there's an order for their deportation or removal. So it's designed to prevent flight risk, and it's designed to prevent danger to the community. What happens, however, is that the way the system is structured and the way certain laws are drafted is that the detention system itself becomes a de facto punishment, and it's designed to wear people down. It's designed to keep people detained until they give up. So there's about, right now ICE, so Immigration and Customs Enforcement, is on set to break the record of the number of people they will detain this year. I can't remember what the daily numbers that they bring into custody, but it should be more than 400,000 folks should be by the end of this government's fiscal year will have been detained in the immigrant detention system.
Another issue that I find is the topic of privatization with immigrant detention. It seems that is more loosely kind of run, and I just wonder if you have any thoughts on that whole situation.
I'm not aware of actually of any immigrant. So the folks are held in immigrant detention in different places. So they're held, which is also part of a mystery, and maybe we can talk a little bit about that.